This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. This week, in the face of calls for more spending and a relaxation of public pay caps, we're asking whether the UK should now end austerity. The Chancellor is not lacking in advice.
The headlines this morning: Boris Johnson has become the latest senior cabinet minister to urge the Chancellor and Theresa May to end the public sector pay cap.
The Conservative mood music has changed. A few of his senior colleagues, some openly, some more circumspectly, are in effect asking the Chancellor for respite from what he himself describes as the hard slog of austerity. Should he heed their advice and take actions such as lifting the 1% cap on public sector pay, or should he stick to his deficit reduction plan? The PM seems to think it should be the latter.
It isn't fair to go out and tell people that they can have all the public spending they want without paying for it.
For now, Philip Hammond says he's holding his nerve and sticking to his plan to eliminate the deficit by 2025. Should he? Or should he give it up? Step inside the briefing room and hear what the expert advice might be. Later on, Paul Johnson from the Institute for Fiscal Studies will brief me on the pressures Philip Hammond is under, and I'll hear the case for and against ditching austerity from two leading economists. But first, I want to know how we came to embrace austerity in the first place. So the BBC's economics correspondent, Andy Verity, visited the briefing room to give me a helpful history.
Has this sort of message become a little too familiar?
We intend to hold public sector pay at a maximum of 1%.
The lesson of what is happening all around us in Europe is that unless we deal decisively with this record budget deficit, then many thousands more jobs will be put at risk in both the private and the public sector.
I know there are many dedicated public sector workers who work very hard and did not cause the recession, but they must share the burden as we pay to clean it up.
Chancellors Alistair Darling and George Osborne in 2010, and we're still hearing the same message 7 years later. But what exactly is austerity? Well, the word comes from a Greek root meaning severe. Economics also comes from the Greek for household management. So austerity is severe household management, getting to a place, in other words, where you're spending no more than your income and making that your top priority. Now, appropriately, it was the fear of becoming a bit like Greece that was first used to justify it. In 2010, the government was spending much more than its income, £152 billion more, an overspend formerly known as a budget deficit. Now, governments normally outspend their income. The last time we didn't was 2003. But it was the 2008 banking crisis that made it unmanageably large. The government's income dropped because the recession meant less economic activity and therefore less tax rolling in. And spending shot up because of how much it cost bailing out the banks and paying unemployment benefit and the like. In March 2010, Labour's last budget drew up a plan for severe household management, deeper cuts in public spending than Mrs. Thatcher ever tried, promising to halve the deficit in 4 years. When George Osborne became Chancellor, he proposed to eliminate it by 2015, and he pinned the blame on Labour overspending. The only way out of this downward spiral, he said, was to cut right back on that household budget.
This is a budget that takes Britain one more big step on the road from austerity to prosperity.
The risk if we didn't, he said, was a Greek-style crisis where investors lose confidence in the UK and refuse to lend to the government or companies unless they get higher interest rates to make up for the risk that they don't get their money back. And higher interest rates would slow down any recovery. It sounded sensible, the Chancellor getting the house in order. Even Labour said it would just do the same, but slower. But it grated with mainstream economists, to whom household management is precisely what economics is not. Unlike a household, a country borrowing in its own currency can't run out of money because it can simply print more. And when households and corporations are pulling their horns in, the government's role, on the mainstream view, is to do the opposite. So someone at least is spending until the recovery is secure. So, did it work? The amount we're overspending by is less than a third of what it once was. The budget deficit is down, but the goalposts keep moving. In 2010, we were promised no deficit at all by 2015. Now, the hope is 2025. Critics say austerity treats the symptom, the overspend, not the disease, which is weak economic growth. Faster growth would cause more tax to roll in, lifting the Chancellor's income, so there'd be less need for cuts. And if the economy's growing faster than our debts, they become more manageable. To others, though, it's not that austerity didn't work, it's that it was never tried. Look at a chart of public spending, and ever since 2010, it's actually risen. Health, schools and overseas aid were exempted from cuts. And while the government did raise VAT, it brought in tax cuts that made it more, not less likely to overspend, like raising the personal allowance. And just as it was talking of austerity, it brought in an expensive triple lock on state pensions, which means welfare spending keeps rising. The truth is that if it really were all about repairing the deficit, it could have been done much more quickly had the government been willing to pay more of a political price by cutting popular services or by raising unpopular taxes. With a hung parliament, that's not so easy.
We are all in this together, and we are going to get through this together. We will carry out Britain's unavoidable deficit reduction plan in a way that strengthens and unites our country.
The big question is, austerity for whom? The decision to exempt health and education means the burden of austerity has fallen on unprotected departments like the Home Office, Police and Fire Service, managing on budgets a fifth lower or more than in 2010. On average, pensioner incomes are higher than they've ever been, and now higher than people of working age, while those under 45 still earn less in real terms than before the crisis. If the intention was for those with the biggest shoulders to bear the biggest burden, has it really worked out that way?
Andy Verity. That's how we got here. But where is here economically? What constraints does the Chancellor face? Paul Johnson is director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies, one of the UK's most trusted and respected economic think tanks. I asked him to brief me on the choices facing Philip Hammond.
Well, Chancellor, you've got the choices Chancellors always have. You can stick to your fiscal plans and get borrowing down over the next few years, but that's going to be pretty tough because that involves more spending cuts on top of the very big spending cuts you've introduced over the last few years. Or you could decide to increase spending whilst increasing taxes to pay for it, but of course that's going to be difficult because you're going to struggle to get any tax increases through Parliament at the moment. Or you could listen to the voices around you and increase spending and borrowing, taking spending up increasing public pay or welfare benefits or whatever it is that you might want to spend money on. But that would mean that borrowing would rise and debt, which is already knocking on for 90% of national income, wouldn't start to come down anytime soon.
Now, let's talk about this public sector pay cap business. What would be the cost of us losing that cap? Nobody likes it.
Well, that's as long as a piece of string, of course. I mean, each 1% additional on public sector pay costs somewhere around £1.5 or £2 billion. So it's a lot. For each 1%, you're spending a lot of money because we spend £180 billion employing people in the public sector, the soldiers and the policemen and the doctors and the nurses and so on. It's important to be clear about two things, though. First, nobody likes the public sector pay cap, but actually public sector workers haven't done any worse than private sector workers over the last decade. The problem problem is we've all done incredibly badly. Secondly, you are going to have to take this cap off at some point, because if you keep this 1% cap for the next 2 or 3 years, then they will start to fall behind what's happening in the private sector. Then you really will start to get to a position where public sector pay is at historically low levels relative to the private sector.
It's not the only area where the government is under pressure to increase spending by any means, is it? I mean, quite apart from the bill for the Democratic Unionist Party, social care, there's pressure on the NHS, the police. What do you think are the areas of most pressure?
Well, it's interesting what you say about social care, because actually Philip Hammond, in the budget in March, he gave more money to social care, recognising there was a crisis there. Probably the health service is the next place to look, because there is no question that performance is falling back, waiting times are rising, A&E targets are being missed, hospitals are going into deficit. So there is real pressure there, despite the fact that in some senses that's been relatively well protected. I think the other big area where the big cuts are in the pipeline, and people aren't talking about very much actually at the moment, is social security spending, welfare spending for people of working age. Don't forget that the 12 billion of cuts, the big cuts to that budget, are still to come, and they're going to come in over the next 4 or 5 years as we roll out universal credit and so on. So there's going to be significant pressure in that area.
So what's going to happen to people in welfare?
Well, we've got several years of freezing of welfare benefits, and with inflation rising up towards 3% at the moment and probably going higher, that's a significant real cut in the value of those benefits. And for working age people with more than two children, they're going to stop getting benefits for third and subsequent children, and the value of both in and out of work benefits for families with children are going to go down.
So if we've heard a lot about food banks in the past, we're going to hear a hell of a lot more about them in the future.
Well, quite possibly. I mean, there is unquestionably on current policy going to be a reduction in the real incomes of people on the lowest incomes of those of working age.
Let's say that I, as Chancellor, say, OK, look, the game's up. I'm going to allow us to run a higher deficit and for a longer time. What's the impact of that longer term?
Well, if you've got a higher deficit for a longer period, then clearly you've got a higher debt into the long run. Now, there's one clear definite impact of that, which is we'll be paying that down for longer and we'll be paying higher interest for longer, but that's entirely manageable. The upside of borrowing more and spending more is, first, you don't have to do these cuts in public services, and secondly, you may support the economy as we go through a pretty probably rocky period as Brexit comes through. The potential downside is, first, if you do this in a poorly managed, non-credible kind of way, as it begins to look like we are, as you know, all parts of the cabinet are saying one thing and another about public pay, for example, then the markets begin to lose confidence and interest rates start to rise. And then there's the sort of small risk of a terrible outcome, which is that if the debt gets too big and then we have a recession and then it's bigger again and we just lose control.
If we did want to have less austerity, but we didn't want to have gigantic deficits, presumably we'd all have to pay more tax, would we?
Yes, we would. I mean, austerity is really been about getting the deficit down from where it was in 2010. It's not actually anything particularly to do with the size of the state. Remember, the size of the state today is exactly the same as it was after 10 years of Labour government back in 2008. So as a fraction of national income, we're spending just as much now as we were after 10 years.
I'm going to ask you the obvious question in that case, Paul. Why does it feel so different then?
The reason that it's like this is that we're used to our income going up 1.5%, 2% a year every year. And the reason it feels bad is we're just much, much, much poorer than we thought we would be. The economy is about £300 billion smaller than we reasonably expected it to be 10 years ago. So we've had a deep recession and a terrible recovery. And so we've just got much less money to spend than we expected to have. And we've actually increased spending on things like pensions in particular, and to some extent on health. And we've reduced spending dramatically in other areas to keep the overall size of the state the same.
Paul, one of the other things that's come up this week is the question of the fall in productivity. What's happened and why does this matter?
Well, what's happened essentially is that we are no more productive for every hour worked than we were 10 years ago, and that's historically unprecedented. Why does that matter? Well, how much we produce each hour in the end determines how much we earn each hour. And you know, the reason the economy has been doing so badly over the last several years is that productivity hasn't been increasing. Now, the deeper question is, why is productivity done so badly? And the answer is, to a large extent, it's a puzzle. There are lots of things. There are lots of things going on there. There's it's something that tends to happen after financial crises, which is what happened in 2008-2009. It's related to the very low levels of interest rates. It's related to low investment over that period by firms, and it's related to actually increases in the numbers of people in lower skilled work.
Ah, that's interesting. Is it fair to say that rather than investing in better technology and equipment, companies have taken on cheap labour?
There might be a bit of that. I mean, certainly the numbers of people in lower paid work has increased. I mean, one of the upsides of the economy is that if you look historically and look at the kind of growth we've had, you would have expected mass unemployment. And we haven't got mass unemployment. What we've got is lots of people in work, but sharing the misery. I mean, everyone's wages have been doing terribly. Remember back to the 1980s, the economy was actually growing reasonably well, but we did have very high levels of unemployment and very quickly increasing inequality. Had exactly the reverse this time round. A big increases in employment and falling inequality, but it's been an inequality of misery.
Paul Johnson. The issue of austerity and deficit reduction is highly contested. Joining me in the briefing room to discuss whether the strategy should now be abandoned are two leading economists with different histories when it comes to this argument. Anne Pettifer is the Director of Policy Research in the think tank Policy Research in Macroeconomics. She is also an economic advisor to Jeremy Corbyn. And Tim Besley is Professor of Economics and Political Science at the London School of Economics and was co-chair of the LSE's Growth Commission. Anne Pettifer, if we take austerity to mean eliminating or significantly reducing the deficit, do you think that is a worthwhile goal to have?
It is indeed, and the only way to do it is for government to spend. So I'm in favour of cutting the deficit, but the way in which it's been done so far is to cut government spending in a slump, and it hasn't worked. It may have reduced the deficit a little bit, but it's made the public debt worse. Cutting government spending after a crisis damages the economy. When you damage a fragile economy, you damage tax revenues. When you damage tax revenues, you cut the government's income. And when you cut the government's income, you increase the deficit and you increase the debt. So the point is to increase government income. And the way to do that is in a time of private sector weakness for the government to spend and stimulate both the private sector but the wider economy, so as to generate the tax revenues that government needs to cut the deficit.
Tim Besley, what do you think the problem with running a deficit is? What impact does it have on the economy and the size of the deficit?
Well, there's inherently no problem with running a deficit, provided you have a strategically inclined plan to see where you're going in the future, namely that you're ultimately going to have to pay back the money you're borrowing today. In the end, you're beholden to people who are going to lend you money, and you have to therefore have a credible plan to repay that money. I think this term austerity now has kind of become a slogan and is best put to one side so that we can have a sort of more sensible discussion. The fact of the matter is that in real terms, public spending is roughly the same today as it was in 2010 when we embarked on the programme of austerity. As a consequence of economic recovery, we've been able to pay down the deficit. So this argument that we butchered the public sector, I think, just doesn't hold up in the numbers. Now, it's true that because we've tried to increase in real terms spending on healthcare, we've had to cut back spending on other areas, and it may be that we want to review that. But by and large, I don't think the share of government in the economy has declined somewhat. But by and large, we've done so by holding in real terms public expenditure fixed.
The problem with that argument is talking about the government as if the government is in isolation. What has happened is the economy has shrunk. What has happened is that both public sector workers and private sector workers have had a period of unprecedented deterioration in both their wages and in their conditions.
Tim Besley.
Well, of course it's about the economy, and of course it's about the productivity challenge that we face. What I'm sceptical about is that government spending is the answer to the productivity challenge that we face, that would raise the revenues, that would pay for the public services that we all so desperately want.
Productivity is a kind of
difficult concept to grasp, really. What is it and why does it matter?
Well, productivity is really about how much people produce in the hours of work that they do. So if someone works for 40 hours per week, the amount they produce is their productivity. What we should be caring about most in the current context is how to get private investment up. If we engaged in a project that was deemed by investors to be fiscally irresponsible, that would result in greater uncertainty and that would certainly diminish the incentive of investors to invest in the UK. Alongside that, there's also the risk that if we push up pay in the economy, that will push up inflation, because if we push up public sector pay, it's likely to spill over into the private sector. That may expedite increases in interest rates by the Bank of England. That means those who perhaps enjoyed a pay increase would also lose out if they have mortgages, so that some of that pay increase would be eaten up in the form of higher interest payments. Equally, we have many people who've taken out debts at low interest rates who would suddenly find it very hard to service those debts if interest rates went up.
The fact of the matter is that there's not enough income in the economy, David. That people's incomes have shrunk. When people's incomes shrink, they don't go shopping, they don't, or they borrow too much, and so on. And so that's still a big problem. So the really important task for government is to raise the level of income across the economy. The best way to do that is to raise public sector incomes and then provide, if you like, some competition to the private sector to encourage the private sector to do the same. When you raise incomes, you raise spending in the economy, which is good for the private sector, but you also raise the possibility of increasing tax revenues. So I would argue very strongly that we need at least a 3% rise for public sector workers, which would amount to something like a half of 1% of total GDP. No, less than a quarter of 1% of GDP. It costs us virtually nothing. And what that would do would be to increase income throughout the economy, which is good for everyone, good for public sector workers, good for the private sector shopkeepers where they spend their money, good for the government because it brings in tax revenues.
Tim Besley, how do you react to that?
Well, I mean, I think I agree with Anne. It would be wonderful to raise people's incomes, but the way to do that in a sustainable long-run way is to raise productivity. Just starting to spend more on public sector workers does nothing.
Yeah, but then we're going around in circles.
Sorry, can I actually finish what I'm saying? Thank you. Just spending more on public sector wages does not deal with the fundamental long-run problem of the UK economy. If it goes into consumption, that is no guarantee that that's going to increase investment in the private sector that will ultimately lead to the higher wages that we want. That's fundamentally about skills, infrastructure, innovation, and access to capital for the private sector. I'm afraid that raising public sector wages, however laudable that might be for other reasons, will not solve the UK's economic problems.
But the argument that Anne Pettifor put forward was that the simple fact of having these people with more money in their pockets would act in itself as the stimulus that then would give the private sector something to latch onto. It seems to me the difficulty, Anne Pettifor, partially with that is it doesn't actually deal with the longer-term problems.
Yes, so there's got to be a twin-track process, actually. On the one hand, incomes must be raised. On the other hand, there has to be public sector investment in skills, in projects which will, you know, raise the British economy's game.
Let's suppose I was the Chancellor, minded to do some of the things that you suggest, or all of them. And then I turned round to you and I said, but, and before I embark upon this course, what are the problems with what you're suggesting?
Well, I mean, everyone says the problem is public debt. So Britain's debt at the moment...
What do you say the problem
is? I say the problem is not... there is no problem with it.
There's no problem at all.
We have, you know, recently the government issued a bond, a gilt. In other words, the government issues something saying, I promise to pay in 30 years' time. It was oversubscribed six times. Private investments are desperate for British government gilts. It's the safest investment you could have. Pension funds are desperate to have long-term returns on their investments. The British government's gilts are the best place to find that, right? So when the government would only issue a bond, it would issue several bonds and it would raise the finance as easily. And it ought to do so now because interest rates are lower than they've ever been in history.
Well, Tim Besley, according to that analysis, this is a clear kind of one-way piece of traffic. There's no, there is actually no significant impediment in Philip Hammond turning around and saying, look, this austerity business, whatever it was attempting to do, it's not working, and I don't want to carry on with it. And actually, furthermore,
I would rather give the message to the economy that it's kind of pretty much open house now.
Well, it would be splendid if that was true, wouldn't it? But I'm really reminded of what people were saying on the eve of the financial crisis, the lack of risk of investing in major banks. Many people said we can invest in this almost risk-free because these banks are bound to repay. The fact is, people have to believe that there is a sound and credible policy in place to be able to borrow at these low interest rates.
Well, we have.
I'm not saying that if we did a little bit of extra borrowing around the margin, we would undermine that. But I think if we went to a wholesale different strategy, I think we'd have a rude awakening around the kinds of rates at which we can borrow, which are unprecedentedly low, I don't doubt. But they're unprecedentedly low because the UK is deemed to be trying to deal with its underlying fiscal issues.
What would that rude awakening, in your view, consist of?
Let's look at our own history. Could we return to the kind of fiscal irresponsibility of the 1970s that led to us calling in the IMF? I think that is unlikely, but not impossible.
I think that's alarmist.
Let's look in our own history to see what the lessons were of last time when we decided that we were not going to have a credible fiscal and monetary framework. We can't forget that there was a period of remarkable instability driven by, a period of both fiscal and monetary irresponsibility, plus an attempt to steer the economy way beyond the capacity of government to actually achieve the end of actually improving productivity and living standards. So I think that's perfectly credible as a way of warning us what could happen.
And Petrov, why do you think that wouldn't happen? Why do you think there is no danger? It says here is a belief in certain sorts of consequences if we go down a certain road. So is there anything in what he's saying that you recognise as being possible, conceivable, dangerous?
No. Public debt is described by the Treasury as constituting 89% of GDP. But in fact, 25% of that is held by another government department. It's called the Bank of England. And real public debt to GDP is about 64%, which is below what it is in the United States. We are, you know, our level of debt is terribly low in real terms. So at the moment, we could very safely spend without any discussion of fiscal irresponsibility.
If you don't mind me asking, who are you having that argument with in your mind? I mean, are you having it because shadow forces are sort of, if you like, kind of deployed in this discussion when we're talking about what would happen. Is your argument with the private sector investors who Tim Besley said would be very worried by this situation? Is your argument essentially not with the Chancellor, but with them saying, look, you don't have to worry, you don't have to run away, you don't have to worry about fiscal, everything will be just
it
great.
Is indeed.
Is that who you're talking to?
I am talking to them, and I know because I worked on the sovereign debt crisis. Investors don't really care about the public debt to GDP. They care about whether an economy is doing well. And at the moment, our economy is anemic, fragile and feeble.
That, I have a feeling, is the only thing that you two will agree about strategically.
Yeah, although, let me say, I think the biggest enemy of private investment is uncertainty. And if you go around and interview private business people, as I have done, in various roles in life, that's the thing you get repeated back to you. If we embarked on an abandonment of our current fiscal strategy, we would raise the level of uncertainty. It's already elevated due to Brexit. And I think that would be what would damage the prospects for private investment. And I think there's a wealth of evidence, both academic evidence and anecdotal evidence, to support the proposition that the one thing we need to avoid at this time is heightening the levels of uncertainty.
Well, that's all we have time for, so my thanks to Andy Verity, Paul Johnson, Anne Pettifer and Tim Besley. My producers for this episode were China Collins and Beth Sager-Fenton. The Briefing Room will be back next week, but given events in the Far East this week, it may be worth you catching up with The Briefing Room's podcast on the Korean crisis. It's on our website. Good night. That's all from The Briefing Room this week. If you'd like to let us know what you think about the series, there's an easy way to do it. Just write a review or rating on iTunes or your podcast provider. We look forward to reading your comments. No, we really do.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.